Welcome to the program. I started doing this show back in 1996. Back in June of 96, I had a guest on the program, a Harvard professor named Michael Sandel, talking about his book at the time, Democracy and Its Discontents. I was not only impressed by the guest, but to this day distinctly remember thinking at the time that getting to talk to people like Michael Sandel was every reason to keep doing this show. 16 years later, we're still here, and it's my pleasure to welcome Michael Sandel back to the program. He was on this show a couple of years ago to talk about his book, Justice. Now he goes right to the heart of what's wrong with our society today. He looks at our cynicism, our lack of civic engagement, our stubborn refusal to engage in real discussion about real issues, and in turn, the way markets have become the sine qua non of every aspect of the way we organize society. These two ideas, seemingly independent, but according to Sandel, very much related to having created the mess that we're in today. Michael J. Sandel is the Ann T. and Robert M. Bass Professor of Government at Harvard University. His work has been the subject of television series on PBS and the BBC. His most recent book was Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do? It is my pleasure to welcome Michael Sandel back to this program to talk about what money can't buy, the moral limits of markets. Michael Sandel, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Jeff. It's great to be back.
Delight to have you here. One of the things about markets taking over our society and kind of filling up this civic space is wondering a little bit about chicken or the egg, whether or not it was the disengagement from civic participation, the sort of bowling alone idea that created the vacuum that markets filled, or whether it was the fact that markets took up all of that space that really turned us off from civic engagement.
Jeff, I think that both are happening. It's coming from both directions. On the one hand, market thinking and market values over the past three decades have been reaching into spheres of life traditionally governed by non-market values and crowding out civic spaces. That's one trend. But at the same time, I think you're absolutely right, there has been an emptiness in our public discourse, a reluctance to engage with big moral questions, questions of justice and the common good. And that's left the way open for what I've called a kind of market triumphalism, the faith that markets are the primary instruments for achieving the public good. So to break through these two tendencies, I think we have to find a way to elevate the terms of our public discourse and to engage more directly with big questions, including the question at the heart of the new book, which is, what should be the role of money and markets in our society?
Part of the problem is that we have gotten so far away from being able to have that public discourse without it becoming the kind of shrill, bitter, talking heads conversation that we're used to seeing on cable television. The other part of it, and sort of the corollary being that when we start to talk about these moral issues, they become bathed for a whole host of reasons in kind of religiosity, which makes it so difficult to talk about.
Well, that's Our public discourse is impaired in just the ways you describe. What passes for political discourse these days too often consists of shouting matches on talk radio and cable television, ideological food fights on the floor of Congress. I think we can do better, but in order to do better, we have to broaden our conception about what it means to bring moral argument into politics. These days, when we think of morality in politics or talk of virtue, we think essentially of two questions, abortion or the debate over same-sex marriage. Now, those are important topics, and they do belong in public discourse, but they're not the only questions that raise moral issues in our politics. And so what I'm hoping in this book to do is to prompt a widening of the moral content of our public discourse to include big questions about the way we organize our economy and the way that markets and market thinking have encroached on almost every sphere of social life over the past three decades. After the financial crisis, it looked as though there would be a kind of renewed attention, a stepping back to reconnect morality in markets, but so far, that hasn't really happened.
from an economic perspective, and economics, as you point out repeatedly, are certainly a part of this and need to be broader in terms of the discussion.
Right.
The divergence that we're seeing, this great divergence between those at the top and those at the bottom, the growing gap there, certainly is adding to this difficulty as well.
Yes, and I think we're seeing two things happening at once. One is the widening gap between rich and poor. And we've had some debates about tax fairness and what is a fair way of allocating the burdens of living together in a society. That's the debate about fair taxes. But the growing gap between rich and poor also is having, I think, a corrosive effect on civic life, our ability to deliberate as citizens about the common good. Let me give you a very concrete example from everyday life. When I was a kid, I'm a baseball fan.
Right.
I grew up in the Midwest in Minneapolis, was a Minnesota Twins fan, and would go to the ballpark. And there's always been a difference between, you know, the box seats and the cheap seats and the bleachers. Back in the mid-60s, when I went to see the Minnesota Twins play, what do you suppose was the difference between the most expensive seat in the stadium and the cheapest one?
Well, I'm cheating. I mean, I know you wrote about this in the book. I mean, it was a dollar difference between the best seat and the worst seat.
It's remarkable. Box seats were something like $3. Maybe bleacher seats were $1. So scarcely, by our standards, scarcely any difference. Now, the effect of this is that going to the ballpark, one encountered people from all walks of life. CEOs and mailroom clerks sat side by side. Everybody waited in the same long lines for the restrooms. And when it rained, everyone got wet. Now, if you look back over the past three decades, that's no longer true. Almost every sports stadium in America now has skyboxes that separate the CEOs and the affluent from the common folks in the stands below. And it's no longer true that everyone waits in the same line for the restroom. It's no longer true that everyone gets wet when it rains. Now, this may seem like a quaint instance from everyday life, but it's been happening, I think, throughout our society. I call it the skyboxification of American life, a tendency for rich and poor increasingly to live separate lives. And quite apart from questions of fairness, this exerts a toll on our civic life because there are fewer and fewer places, public spaces, where we encounter one another from different walks of life in the ordinary course of life. And that makes it very difficult to summon the social solidarity that democratic citizenship requires.
And as you point out, that it doesn't require a common equality necessarily, but the ability to share a common life, the idea that we do, as you say, just bump into each other in the course of life, and we've created a situation in skyboxification where a certain group of society really gets to opt out, to buy their way out of any dealing with the public.
We see this perhaps most consequentially in schools and in education.
And in healthcare.
In healthcare is another example. In the case of schools, the affluent either opt out of public schools if they're poor public schools or wrought with violence, or they're able to move to affluent suburbs where the public schools are still outstanding. And this is a real problem, not only because the weak public schools are left as places for people who can't afford to buy their way out. That's bad enough. But it also separates us, one from another, within the society. Similar thing is happening, as you mentioned, in healthcare. I talk in the book about the advent of concierge or boutique medical practices, where you can, if you pay an annual retainer fee now in most communities, you can sign up for a concierge medical practice where the physician reduces substantially his or her roster of patients to a relative handful, but gives them, in exchange for a hefty annual fee ranging from $2,500 to $25,000, same-day appointments, even the cell phone number of your doctor. Now, that's great care if you can afford it, wonderful personal attention, But what it means is all of the other patients, the ones who can't afford the retainer fee, are shunted onto the increasingly crowded roles of other physicians. We see it also in the military, the marketization of goods. In Iraq and Afghanistan, there were more paid military contractors on the ground than there were U.S. military troops. Now, we never had a public debate, Jeff, about whether we wanted to outsource war to private companies. But that is what has happened over the past three decades. And what I'm trying to suggest in the book is that we need to have a public debate about where markets serve the public good and where they don't belong.
Given how hard it is, jumping back a little bit, given how hard it is to have that public debate in this environment, and given how far along we are in this process of skyboxification, and that the financial crisis really arguably made less of a difference than one might have expected in all of this, do you see any way to put that genie back in the bottle? How do we begin to even think about turning that around?
The first step is to be more aware of what's happened over the last three decades. It's not through any deliberate choice. It's as though we've drifted, really since the 1980s and 90s, we've drifted from having a market economy to becoming a market society. The difference is this: a market economy is a tool. It's a valuable and effective tool for organizing productive activity. But a market society is a place where everything is up for sale. It's a way of life where market values seep into every sphere of life, from personal relations to education to health to military service to civic life. And so the first step is to recognize what's been happening. And then the second step is to try to summon the political will and imagination to recast the terms of our public discourse so that we spoke about the shouting matches earlier on. It's really we go back and forth between having shouting matches or purely managerial technocratic kinds of approaches to our politics. And what's missing is a morally robust engagement with big questions about the economy, about the distribution of income and wealth, and also about where money and markets belong and where we should try to keep them at a distance to protect other goods, including civic goods. So we need to find a way to have that debate. And that's not an easy thing to do, I agree. And the media, for the most part, is not set up to encourage that debate. The political parties have not embraced it. So I think until we build citizen demand and insistence for a debate about bigger questions, including questions about the place of markets, we can't expect the political parties by themselves to produce it for us.
Do we have to then use the tools that are available to us now in order to get to this point? In other words, to the extent that we have commodified everything, do we have to find ways to incentivize this debate? I mean, it not in as blatant a way, but maybe in the way that, for example, you know, Cass Sustren talks about in this whole idea of nudging people to a certain place.
Well, I think rather than incentivize, we should inspire this kind of debate. And I think it's an important difference. Actually, the word incentivize is being used widely now.
Right.
It's part of the common currency. And when I was doing research for the book, I looked up the history of the language of incentives and incentivizing. It's interesting. Talk of incentives abounds these days in political talk and economic discourse especially. The classical economists, Adam Smith, for example, never once used the word incentive. It's really a product of the late 20th century, and the word incentivize reflects the market-driven approach to life that has increasingly predominated. The word incentivize, I discovered, to my surprise, only becomes common in newspapers, in books, in political discourse, in the 2000s and since. It was scarcely even used before then. So even the language we use to discuss our public life and public policy has been made over in the image of a certain economic way of thinking. So what I think we need to do to try to shake ourselves out of this and step back and question this way of thinking about public life and conducting it is to try to inspire the kind of morally robust public debate that I think people are hungry for. Now, we'll need to rely on venues, convening forums, media outlets, such as this program, Jeff, because if we look around us, so much of the media rewards the shouting matches and the inflammatory rhetoric and does not invite citizens of competing views, because people do disagree about big moral questions, how to value health or education or military service or civic life. We need to find venues and occasions where we can have serious, morally engaged public reasoning about these questions, and we need to try to rebuild the civic infrastructure of democratic life. We need to try to rebuild class-mixing institutions, public schools where everyone, rich and poor, would want to send their kids. And I think if we did that, not an easy thing, that those who were in the skyboxes would actually find it an attractive alternative. See, my reason for hope is a hunch. I don't think those of us who may inhabit skyboxes actually would ideally like to be separated from our fellow citizens. But we feel, look, the public schools are not good enough. Public transportation is not good enough. The public health clinic or municipal center or cultural institution is not good enough, so we opt out if we can afford it. But I think that there is something missing in even in the life of the sky, those who inhabit the skyboxes, that would make the shared spaces of democratic citizenship very appealing if only we could rebuild them and reconstruct them. But that's a massive, admittedly a massive undertaking. But it's a civic project, and the flourishing of our democracy, I think, ultimately depends on it.
To what extent do you think some of it may take place as a result of simple geography and demographics? You know, part of this happened, or this a lot of this went on, as there was this great migration to the suburbs and then the exurbs and the kind of isolation that we saw for so many years. We're now seeing this counter trend where we have more and more people moving back to cities, to urban environments where they're forced to bump up against each other. And one wonders whether this will have some kind of countervailing impact.
Well, I think that it could, and it's an encouraging development. There's a big difference between doing your everyday errands and shopping, even at a shopping mall to which you have to drive, or a series of big box stores with asphalt parking lots as far as the eye can see. A big difference between that way of shopping, even, and going to a downtown area where there are retail stores and eating places and banks and municipal facilities and the public library and, who knows, maybe even a museum, a health clinic, a workout facility, all within walking distance. Because those dense, mixed-use forms of downtown life or of city life or of town centers provide, exactly as you say, Jeff, an occasion for the inadvertent mixing of people from different walks of life that real commonality requires. To go back to the baseball game analogy, we didn't go to the ballpark for a civic experience. We went to see to root for the home team. But almost by inadvertence, the fact that going to the ballpark used to be a class mixing experience, that exerted a healthy influence on democratic life, on the way we thought of one another as fellow citizens. And so the revival of downtown areas and city centers and town centers can exert a similar influence, again, to counteract the effect of a kind of atomized sprawl that we have in so many places today, where we drive to the asphalt parking lot mm-hmm. in a shopping mall.
You, at Harvard, you're at ground zero in terms of the younger generation and how they're looking at this. Talk a little bit about how the younger generation sees it, particularly in light of and in the context of technology, which is in some ways isolating. Social networking, people that are glued to looking at the little screen on their phone while they're texting or doing whatever it is that they're doing. I mean, that's isolating in a way for a new generation.
It is and can be isolating, and I worry even within the classroom. I know many of my colleagues do, that we as teachers are now competing with ESPN.com or Facebook or email traffic. Some professors have turned off the internet access in the classroom, which may be one solution. So there is a competition for the attention of students, and staring at a screen can be isolating. And it also poses another risk, which is the more we get our news and information from online sources, but we've seen this also with cable television mm-hmm. and talk radio, the greater the tendency to be insulated from opinions with which we disagree, because we go to blogs or we listen to cable networks that simply tell us what we already believe, reinforce our existing opinions, and don't confront us, as the old network evening news used to, or the newspapers, and the quality newspapers that
right.
flourished through the 20th century, exposing us to inadvertent, unsought opinions that may diverge from our own, news and information, especially from around the world, that we might not have sought out on a blog or a website, but that's nonetheless important. These are broadening influences. So I think that the technology and the internet and the staring at the screens can be isolating existentially, but also ideologically. And we need to find ways of fashioning compelling media alternatives that are convening places for people who disagree rather than venues that simply reinforce what we already think.
In some ways, it's even worse than that, because beyond the confirmation bias that you're talking about, there's also the interest bias.
Yes.
People are only looking at things or getting feeds from and around subjects they're interested in.
That's right. And what's happening is that the media environment is a way of boosting profits and advertising revenue. Is targeting viewers as consumers and reinforcing their consumer identities. And that's, I think, what you're referring to as this interest-driven kind of coverage that
right.
is available online and through blogs that are targeted and narrowly targeted. But the risk is our consumer identities are crowding out our civic identities. And to shore up our civic identities, I think we need to find forms of media, ways of delivering news and information and opinion that challenge viewers with perhaps surprising views disparate from their own. That's what I try to do in the classroom, but I think we have to do it in our society writ large, and we haven't really found a way to lean against the isolating tendencies of the online world.
How do we also fight the tendency of, for lack of a better word, laziness? And I know that's not fair, but given the economics crisis that still exists in large swatches of the country, there is a desire on the part of many not to engage, not to want to have to do the hard work of civic engagement after doing the hard work of just trying to stay afloat.
Well, one can think of it as work, and it does require a certain commitment. But ideally, engaging in civic life should be exciting. It should be energizing. It should be inspiring. And what the unfortunate turn in our public life toward technocratic, managerial, market-driven discourse makes attending to public life and public affairs a chore. And so I think that's one of the reasons people are so frustrated with politics. And one of the main points of my book, What Money Can't Buy, is to say we need to reinvigorate our public discourse, and to do that, we need to ask hard questions and to debate politically difficult, controversial questions about where, about what role money and markets should play in our society, and what civic goods and human relationships are undermined or eroded or crowded out if markets and market values hold sway everywhere and govern every sphere of life.
Can we find places in the world, places in the West, anywhere, where in fact they have gotten beyond this, where they're doing it the right way? And is there anything we can learn from that?
I think there are pockets of civic energy and dynamism throughout this country, within civil society for the most part, the spaces that lie between government on the one hand and the market on the other. Those are, government and market are not the only ways of organizing life or animating civic activism. And so I think that sometimes we find these venues, these pockets of civic energy in religious communities, in social movements, in unions, though unions have become weaker and weaker, in the local associations of various kinds that form around various various ideals and shared commitments. Cities and towns can sometimes be venues for civic activism and engagement and public discourse. But we need to begin to rebuild these places as a counterweight to the momentum of markets and market-dominating thinking, dominated thinking on our lives. And that's, I think, is our biggest civic challenge today.
Professor Michael Sandel, the book is What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets, just out from Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Michael, always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Jeff, thank you. I always enjoy coming on your show and engaging in the discussions. You provide a model for the civic discourse that we sorely lack in this country.
Thank you.